Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. It's been called the most rapidly evolving area in healthcare, telemedicine. The technology allows doctors far away to connect to you where you are, which opens the possibilities to treatments that otherwise not be readily available. It's even possible that telemedicine could be used to fight the opioid crisis. But it is not without its challenges, and we'll talk about the pros and cons in this hour. What's your telemedicine experience? Whether you're a doctor or a patient, we want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk with us about telemedicine are two knowledgeable people, Kevin Curtis, Medical Director of Connected Care at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, an emergency department physician, and Elisa Dresba, Director of the New Hampshire Rural Health and Primary Care at New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So let's start our conversation establishing what telemedicine is. We often hear the term telehealth as well. That's interchangeable, right, Kevin? Is that the same, telemedicine, telehealth?
I really think of them as interchangeable now.
Yep. Yeah. And how does it work exactly?
Sure. Well, there are still a variety of definitions out there of what telemedicine is, but I think the one that I like the best because it really helps us frame what we're talking about 90% of the time is, so it's delivery of healthcare, so diagnosis, consultation, treatment. It's live, it's interactive, it involves audio and video, and it's over a secure connection. So maybe if you're framing it in your mind, it could be medical FaceTime and involving some physical exam. So again, needs to include that video component, but really a medical visit that is kind of like a FaceTime.
Mm-hmm. But you couldn't use FaceTime or a program like Skype, for example, right? Because those aren't properly secured?
Exactly. So a huge part of that definition and of telemedicine is that it's a secure platform and it maintains that same level of confidentiality that you would want when you see your doctor in a traditional way.
Mm-hmm. And what about where you go for it? I mean, sometimes you can do it at home, but that's under, a limited circumstance.
Sure. So if you think about the different places that you currently get healthcare, we used to think about telemedicine as a lot of technology with a little medicine mixed in, and really it has switched to, I think, the way that we think about it now is it is another medical visit that happens to be a little different technically. So think about where you currently get your medical care and how. So it can be certainly in a hospital. It can be in an emergency room. It can be when you're admitted to a hospital. It can be in your doctor's office. It could be in another outpatient setting. Or, as you say, it can sometimes be at home.
Mm-hmm. And Elisa, you work in rural health. Is it used quite a bit in rural New Hampshire?
It is more so now. It's taken a while over the past decade to really develop. And what we've found is that providers in rural health tend to be a lot more innovative and flexible and open because they have to be with the limited resources. Mm-hmm. So we've seen quite a bit of uptick in folks taking advantage of federal grant opportunities to start programs like telepsychiatry and tele-NICU and tele-stroke and tele-trauma and things like that. And what it does is it allows them to serve their community with a capacity that otherwise wouldn't be present. So we've really seen that take on and really come up in the past few years. The place that it had been beforehand were really two places. One is in radiology. And so what some of the critical access hospitals were doing is something called night hawking, where they would take films and then they would be read overnight by a radiologist in another country. So our night would be their day. And then the next morning, the providers would come in, and those films would have been read, and then all the clinical notes would be there from a provider. And it was a way of extending capacity for those little hospitals. The other place that we've seen it is in home health monitoring. So we have, you know, as you can imagine, you have not a very dense population, and you have a certain patient load that needs to be seen by nurses. And so this, in between those in-person nurse visits, they can do some home health monitoring where there's a monitor. The person has a certain protocol they do every day. They get on, they check their blood pressure, they check in. That is sent to a central monitoring station by a nurse's agency, and they can see that the patient has checked in and what their vitals are. And if there's anything concerning, they can do follow-up call or visit with that.
So the patient would be essentially given or loaned some equipment that would establish that secure connection we were talking about earlier, so that they could just check in with the nurse every now and then.
Correct.
Great. And what about at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, Kevin? How is telemedicine being used there?
Sure. So we started our Center for Telehealth in 2012, and really with a mission of trying to help deliver outstanding care using telemedicine to the region, independent of patient's location, and really doing it with extensive community partnerships with community organizations, with community healthcare teams. And so with that mission, we currently have 7 telemedicine service areas, and 6 which are acute care. So those include teleemergency, tele-ICU or intensive care, teleneurology, that includes the telestroke, telepsychiatry, telepharmacy, and teleurgent care. Mm-hmm. And then we also have our outpatient or appointment type specialty areas, which we refer to as telespecialty, and that'll include a whole bunch of medical fields. So that could be nephrology if you have kidney issues, that could be gastroenterology, that could be child development, that could be pediatric pulmonary, that could be weight and wellness. So those acute care services, just to frame it a little bit, so if you were at a hospital and we were working together, and we work together with communities and hospitals whenever they ask for help. We want to identify, and for them to identify for us, what is the need and what are the gaps and what are the situations where telemedicine might be a solution. Mm-hmm. So if your local hospital had teleemergency, then when you go into an emergency room, there will be a unique in the corner camera, video screen, microphone. And in addition to your local care team, our teleemergency team that sits in a hub of a doc and a nurse can join in your local team and help provide care in whatever way you ask or the local team asks or the patient prefers.
And does that cut down on wait times?
It may. So one of the things is teleemergency or teleneurology or telestroke, they tend to get involved in the sicker people. What that allows the bedside team is really to stay focused on the patient. And by doing that, it helps the operation of the rest of the area work more efficiently. Mm-hmm. So it can translate to decreased waiting times.
Now, why do people who use it through Dartmouth-Hitchcock use it? Do they use it because they don't want to travel, or is it because the kind of care they can get through telemedicine is something that they simply can't get anywhere else? Or maybe it's a combination of the two.
I think it's definitely a combination. So as Alicia said, you know, there are tremendous rural healthcare needs in our region and in our state. And certainly a primary area of focus for telemedicine for us is on rural communities. And as she is the expert on, even more so than me, but the challenges of getting particularly specialty care in a rural community are tremendous. And those challenges, if you live in Lancaster and you need to see a specialist in the summer, that's a day off from work, that's travel expense, that is disruption of your life. Never mind if it's winter. So how do we bring that specialty care to helping people get the best care right in their communities? And telemedicine is just so well aligned to do that.
Mm-hmm. And Alisa, you're nodding to his comments there. So is that, you agree with that?
Yes, I do. That is very accurate. What you have in rural areas a lot of times is a volume issue. And what I mean by that is that your costs are fixed and stay the same, but how you pay for the provision of care is based on volume, how many things you can bill and get paid for. And so if you have folks who come in sporadically with certain kinds of issues, it's just not cost effective to have certain kinds of specialties hired and literally sitting in their offices waiting to see folks. But what we want to make sure is that people have access, particularly if it's a time-sensitive condition, something like a stroke, so that we can get the right care to them as quickly as possible. Our concern really is around equity, that just because of your geography, you shouldn't have less care and less quality care and less access.
We're talking about telemedicine today with some knowledgeable people who are ready to answer your questions about it. You can also share your story. We'd love to hear your experience with telemedicine. Do you have an experience? What was it like? Did you enjoy it? Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Alisa, you're heavily involved in issues involving rural health. So how important is telemedicine right now for people in rural New Hampshire?
I think the potential is really great. I think the other thing that we need to remember is that it's not a solution for every single issue in rural. It definitely helps increase access to care. It helps extend care. It helps, as we mentioned, keep people from having to leave their jobs to access care hours away. It helps with no-show rates. Some studies have shown is that. But it is not we have some fundamental workforce issues that it can't address, and a lot of this is around primary care and the provision of primary care, and there's just the shortage that we have in the state for primary care in certain areas.
It's been said that it's growing pretty rapidly. Why? Why do you think it's growing so quickly? We'll start with you, Alisa.
I think that there has been, in the beginning, there was not a lot of documentation and evidence on quality and return on investment. And I think that as people have sort of taken the leap and taken that risk and then documented and created that evidence base and research, there has been a greater acceptance of it. I think that the patient acceptance and the provider acceptance has really surprised people. We found that when we did an emergency department early pilot that was actually reimbursed by Medicaid, where people come into emergency department and they're in crisis, and people's acceptance rate for talking with someone through what is essentially a television screen and interacting with those folks and getting care was much higher than we expected it to be. And so I think that really sort of kicked off the idea that that this is something that could be good for New Hampshire.
And what do you think, Kevin? Is that contributing to the growth as well?
I completely agree. And that evidence continues to grow and become more robust. As we mentioned about stroke, for example, we know that with telemedicine and, for example, with our teleneurology service, in a rural hospital that can't have 24/7 neurologists, we can treat stroke at the same quality as a urban stroke center by well-established metrics. I think the other things that contribute to its growth, one is just technology itself. Right? So obviously the pervasiveness of the internet, the fact that people have so many smart devices and familiarity with it, and particularly as we move more effectively into people's homes, that is a very comfortable way for them to consider care. And also, as broadband technology continues to grow, the effectiveness and the reliability of that. And then even though it is not where we want it to be yet with the growth of reimbursement, then it becomes a decision for the patient, the family, and the provider of what is the best way to deliver this care, telemedicine or traditional, based just on those things, not based on what the reimbursement is.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question about telemedicine or an experience with it, whether you are a provider or a patient. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Jenna in Portsmouth. Jenna, thank you very much for calling.
Yes, hi, it's Janice, actually.
Oh, Janice, pardon me.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually a provider in New Hampshire. I'm a therapist, and I'm licensed in the state of New Hampshire, and I really like the option of telemedicine or telehealth. One of the things that I've found that's been difficult is that I am licensed by the Board of Psychology in the state of New Hampshire, but if I have a patient that moves or does a program in the state of Chicago or the state of Florida or the state of Texas, I need to get licensed in the state of Florida, Chicago, or Texas. So the state licensing boards say you're practicing without a license if you practice telehealth medicine, if your patient goes on vacation or if your patient is in a 10-month program in a different city. I actually need to get licensed within that state to be able to provide them with any telehealth medicine.
And
that's a real obstacle.
Okay. Yeah, well, Janice, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. And I think more broadly, that speaks to the issue of laws. Our laws, it doesn't seem so in Janice's case, but our laws, from your perspective, Kevin, keeping up with the technology of telemedicine?
I don't know if they're keeping up with it, but I think there is significant growth. So what I would say is there's a lag behind things like reimbursement and laws with telemedicine, but that it continues to expand. And I think that challenge with licensing is certainly a real one. There are efforts that have been made with interstate medical compact licenses where licensing in one state will extend to multiple others, but it's not where it can be. And as telemedicine and demand grows, I suspect those laws will catch up.
How about the way the states of Vermont and New Hampshire work together? I mean, you're right on the border. Does that ever present to be an issue, licensing-wise?
It does present an issue. And for most of our services, if people have been, we have a lot of providers who already in traditional medicine practice in both locations. So we're in those situations, we're fine. But for providers whose license is in New Hampshire and telemedicine will now extend that to Vermont, they get an additional license, medical license in Vermont.
I see. We're talking about telemedicine today, and the number for you to call is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear your stories, whether you are a patient or a doctor. What's your experience? How did it look from your end? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange.
NHPR Summer Car Raffle is back.
Oh my gosh, are you for real?
You could drive away with $2,000 in gas cards to use at any gas station, or you could win the grand prize, $25,000 toward a new car.
No, I never won anything before. That's terrific. I'm going to hyperventilate now.
But you can't win if you don't play. Get your raffle tickets now, just $50 each, or six for $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and the doctor is virtually in today as we discuss telemedicine, its pros and cons, and how it works here in New Hampshire. What's your experience with telemedicine? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We're here with Elisa Drusba, Director of New Hampshire Rural Health and Primary Care at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, and Kevin Curtis, Medical Director of Connected Care at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. And joining us for this part of the program is Jean Ryer, Director of the New Hampshire Citizens Health Initiative at UNH's Institute for Health and Health Policy and Practice, whose telehealth program, Project Echo, addresses maternal substance abuse. Jean, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good morning, Peter, and thank you, and hi to your other guests.
Good morning.
So, Jean, let's talk about Project Echo. Tell us about it. What is it?
So Project Echo falls under what we might call telehealth instead of telemedicine. So if we think about telemedicine being a one-on-one interaction between a healthcare provider and a patient, telehealth is a bigger umbrella term that encompasses a lot of other activities, including things like the telemonitoring that Elisa mentioned, people using smartphones to do various healthcare tracking activities. It includes education activities and consultations between specialists and primary care providers. So what Project Echo is doing is it's using web-based teleconferencing, so something like Skype or FaceTime, to connect specialists and experts with community healthcare providers, doctors and nurses and physician assistants working out in in the communities, including rural communities, to help them increase their expertise and their confidence and their competence in dealing with complex illnesses that they might otherwise have to refer into a major center like Dartmouth-Hitchcock or somewhere like that. So it works in by bringing together a small group of expert faculty and then getting doctors and nurses out in communities together once a week or once a month. They share some a little lecture, a short lecture called a didactic lecture to get some new knowledge. And then the local doctors or nurse teams present one of the cases that they're having struggles with, something that's really challenging for them. And they present the case. They get the advice from the experts on the case. They get advice on the case from their peers all around the state or the region. And then everybody learns. So this has been around for more than a decade. It was started by a liver specialist in New Mexico who was really frustrated that the patients he was, first of all, there were long waiting lists for appointments to see him, months and months to get in to see him. And by the time patients got in, often he could no longer really help them. So he started using this kind of technology to reach out to local healthcare providers and teach them to manage patients better at home. And then only the sickest people who really needed him had to go into the major academic medical center.
So
it's been great.
It's been great. Okay. And what would it look like for someone who needs the treatment? Where would they go to start participating in Project ECHO, and what would they encounter?
So the Project ECHO doesn't work with patients. So it works with the providers and with the experts. So there's no actual patients involved. The individual patients case may be presented by their own local doctor in a completely de-identified way so that no one will know who it is, so their privacy is protected. But again, this is a telehealth technology, and it's not a telemedicine technology where the patient and the doctor are working one-on-one. This is increasing the knowledge of the doctors and healthcare providers in the community to help more patients.
And is it also increasing the number of doctors who are participating in this kind of service?
It really has been growing exponentially around the country and around the world. We've been trying to bring it to New Hampshire for a few years now, and we were successful in partnering with Maine and Vermont to get a Northern New England Project ECHO network into the three states together. So right now we have an ECHO session for people who are caring for moms and babies with different kinds of substance use disorders, so obstetricians, pediatricians, family practice, midwives, and substance use disorder specialists are all working on that. And then this summer in August we'll start one for providers working to offer medications for addiction treatment for opiate use disorder, and that will be kicking off in August and September.
I see. You mentioned that one of the inspirations for the program like this was a doctor, a liver specialist, who said there were long waiting lists. Are there long waiting lists for people waiting for maternal substance abuse treatment, and is this expected to sort of alleviate that?
I think the issue with maternal substance use treatment is not so much that they're waiting list, because people are going to have the babies whether there's a waiting list or not, but increasing the confidence of the providers in what are the best practices, what's the evidence, what's proven to be work the best so they can serve those patients the best. For the medications for addiction treatment, for opiate addiction, I think the issue there is different. We have a lot of providers who have the special license that is required, but it doesn't appear that they're taking care of as many patients as they can, and it doesn't appear that they're taking care of as many patients as need the treatment. So it's going to we're hoping that it will increase the access to treatment for medications for opiates by doing this and helping those healthcare providers feel like they really are confident that they can manage this condition well, that they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is holding New Hampshire back from getting more involved in telehealth to combat the opioid crisis?
I think you've heard some echoes of some of the concerns already. Oh, that's a bad pun, echo. But, you know, there's issues of payment. There's issues of licensure. There are, you know, one really practical aspect of all of this is how people fit it into the flow of work in their office or their practice.
You're getting nods around the table here.
Oh, well, that's good. It's kind of funny to
some
be
agreement
up on the
here.
Phone.
Yeah.
So that's a big obstacle, but without the payment, it becomes a bigger problem. Now, New Hampshire took a big step forward several years ago on that, but I don't think we've really finished the job. I don't think it's patient resistance for the most part, because now people of all ages are using Skype and FaceTime to interact with family members, with grandkids. So I don't think that's the issue. The big thing that's changed is the technology. It used to be really expensive, and you had it in one room in a clinic. Now, we can do Project Echo from a laptop or a smartphone, and people, the faculty experts can be anywhere. The community provider can be in their office. We had an obstetrician joined from the hallway outside the delivery room one day because she had just delivered a baby kind of off schedule. So the technology and the cost of the technology are no longer the problem. And even in rural New Hampshire, where for years we didn't have good high-speed internet, now at least in most of the areas around hospitals and clinics, we do have good high-speed internet. So that's no longer a barrier either.
Well, Jean Ryer, thank you very much for speaking with us and telling us about Project Echo. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
That's Jean Ryer, director of the New Hampshire Citizens Health Initiative at UNH's Institute for Health Policy and Practice. We're talking about telemedicine today, and we'd love to hear your stories, how it's been helpful for you or not. If you are a provider, how does it fit into your practice? Have you incorporated it into the way you practice medicine? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I want to go back to the question of growth in telemedicine, because it's growing not just here, but nationwide. But is it being used proportionate to its growth? And I'll ask you, Elisa, what do you think?
So I would say in New Hampshire, it is not being used. Like we talked about earlier, it's certainly more prevalent than it was. And I think that more people have a baseline understanding of what it is. But as far as that translating to actual use, I don't think we're there. As Jean mentioned, we do have that broadband capability around facilities themselves. But we haven't quite broken that barrier to where people would have access wherever they chose to utilize telehealth. So if they're more comfortable or it's more timely for them to use their smartphone to access care, they may not be able to do that in some of the dead zones that we have in rural New Hampshire. And once again, it's a volume issue up there as far as making an investment in laying all of that actual physical infrastructure for so few people.
And Kevin, what do you think?
I think that's completely true, and it is also indicative of the national use of telemedicine. So the estimates are in 2013 that there were something like 350,000 telemedicine encounters in the country, and this year the estimate is 5 million. So that's obviously exponential growth. Maybe it's whatever that is, 14 or 15 times greater. By the same token, it's estimated that telemedicine is used in 1% of the situations where it could be beneficial. So I think the growth is great, but the penetration is still small.
Okay? And it's not just technology that accounts for that anymore, is it?
It's not. So it's a new field still, even though we've been doing a form of it for a while. So some of the things we've talked about that are increasing the growth are certainly true, the technology and the rural focus. On the other hand, it's still, there is more opportunity for adoption, and that includes adoption still at the patient side, even though the satisfaction with it is tremendous. They say that 2/3 of the patients are interested or willing to try a telemedicine encounter, and once they do, about 90% find it was as good or better. But there's still, there is a period of adoption there. There is adoption that needs to occur by providers, and there's adoption that needs to occur by payers, meaning insurance companies, and by health systems. So I think that opportunity is great. It is similar, I think, a little bit to our experience at Dartmouth. So on the one hand, you know, we're probably at 1,700 teleneurology encounters and 2,600 in telespecialty, which are great numbers, and most of that has occurred over the last couple of years. On the other hand, the opportunity to increase that tenfold is out there.
So if I am a patient at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, I go back regularly for an illness that would qualify for telehealth. Has Dartmouth-Hitchcock built into its routine to tell the patient, say, hey, by the way, you could take advantage of telehealth so you wouldn't have to come all the way to Dartmouth-Hitchcock. You can go to a site closer to you. Is that something that's built in a patient education process?
It's in the early stages, and the stage it's in depends on the medical field. And really, some of that comes back to the availability of the provider and the level of adoption of that field. So really where we're trying to get is just where you're alluding to. So say, for example, you get that letter in the mail that says, please call us to schedule your appointment in gastroenterology. What we'd like to happen, and I think will happen in the near future, is it will say, when would you like it, what time and what day, and would you like this appointment to be in person, or would you like it to be by telemedicine? So it is just a small piece, and it is patient preference defined for most appointments.
It's all about telemedicine today on The Exchange, and we'd love to hear your stories. We're going to take a short break in just a moment. The number for you to call is 1-800-892-6477. When we come back, we could talk a little bit about the issue of payment, which is always there when it comes to healthcare, perhaps made a little more complicated by telemedicine, but perhaps not. Depends on your stories, of course. We'd love to hear them. 1-800-892-6477. Have you made a healthcare decision whether or not to use telemedicine based on cost, based on insurance reimbursement? Give us a call. Let us know your story. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we are talking about telemedicine today, how it works in New Hampshire, where it's headed, how it's paid for. Tell us about your experience. 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. We're here in the studio with Kevin Curtis, Medical Director of Connected Care at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, and Elisa Dresba, Director of New Hampshire Rural Health and Primary Care at the State Department of Health and Human Services. And we turn now to Kathy Lear, a physical therapist at Family Physical Therapy Services in Bedford. They offer telemedicine services directly to patients. Kathy, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Peter, for having me.
So tell us, how is telemedicine used at your office?
Well, as everyone has said this morning, it's still in its infant stages, but we are we have programs for low back pain as well as knee programs, and we also have a program called Ask a PT where people can call in and ask questions about their aches and pains.
And when you say call in, is that a video call?
For Ask a PT, it's a free service, so it can be on the telephone or it can be email. If it turns into a televideo or a telemedicine visit, it would be through televideo and a third party that we go through for that to make sure it's all HIPAA and high-tech compliant.
Gotcha. You got to keep everything private and secure. What do Absolutely. Patients say when they experience this or when they go through the process? What do they say to you about it?
You know, like I said, it's still in its infant stages. Those people who have utilized it love it. But we are running into some, you know, societal barriers where, you know, physical therapy, outpatient physical therapy, is traditionally hands-on, in-office delivery of service. So to change those paradigms on how traditionally physical therapy is delivered has become a barrier to care itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what do patients expect when they go to a physical therapy session that is conducted by telehealth? Is anybody guiding their motions in trying to help them rehabilitate?
Well, pretty much much it's going to be similar to an in-office visit. You know, if we evaluated a patient, we have certain procedures or methods to test for their range of motion and their strength, their balance, things of that nature. In subsequent visits, follow-up visits, we can actually visualize a limb if they're swelling, visualize a post-op wound. We can watch how they move, or in many cases, their lack of movement, and then provide guidance with regards to their exercises and their care.
What about the money part? Does it save money for patients or providers or both?
It can. In the state of New Hampshire, we do have parity laws. So if we provide a treatment through an insurance, if somebody has the insurance coverage, the insurance companies have to pay that just as, in the same manner that they would pay an in-office visit. But there's many savings if you think about that from a provider perspective. You know, with telemedicine, we wouldn't have the overhead. We'd be able to, you know, not have downtime between patients if we give a window of treatment. So we could see more patients in a given number of time. From a beneficiary's perspective, you know, the patients themselves can save money with regards to their travel costs, the time that it takes to get to and from a visit, as well as the time that they spend in the visit. There's emotional and psychological costs as well in terms of, you know, being away from the office, being away from the family, not being able to, you know, the amount of time that they should be doing something else. And of course, with regards to continuation of care when people are traveling for work or for pleasure, because we can continue to provide that treatment, there's no interruptions, and some of the delays that interruption of coverage or treatment produce can be prevented. So their outcomes are going to be better. Their outcomes are going to be more timely. So costs can be saved at that end of the spectrum as well.
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for telling us how it works at your shop. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Kathy J. Lear, a physical therapist at Family Physical Therapy Services in Bedford. And we'll go back now to Kevin Curtis and Elisa Drusba, because Kathy was talking about, you know, the cost to one's life being sort of reduced somewhat. You spend less time away from your family, you have to travel less. But what about the cost after the visit? I mean, after a medical visit, we get billed through insurance or billed directly if we're paying cash. What's it like to interact with a health insurance company with respect to telemedicine? Is it different, Elisa?
I think it depends on who your payer is. So sort of the base guidelines for a lot of what we reimburse for in healthcare is established by Medicare, which is a federal program. And so often what will happen is states which have the flexibility to alter their Medicaid programs will base a lot of their reimbursement policies on Medicare, and then other payers will follow. And so it really depends on who your payer is. I think the most important thing, of course, always with healthcare is to really make sure that you understand what is and isn't reimbursed so that you don't have any surprises. And so it is, unfortunately, you can't just assume that everything's going to be paid for or that your particular provider participates in all of the different options that are out there. So as a patient, you really need to do that. I wish that wasn't the case, but it is. And I think that we have seen, you know, just in our Medicaid program here in New Hampshire, what they've done is they've done that baseline level of Medicare. But what they've done is Medicare requires that the originating site, the place that the patient sits and gets the care delivered to them, is in a rural or a underserved and rural area. And what our New Hampshire Medicaid has done is they've eliminated that requirement. So it really is available statewide, which I think is a great idea, and it's a great way to see what the potential it really is across the board for populations. I think that it's very risky to assume that certain populations are going to need it or are going to want to get involved more than other populations. And I think what we want to do is we want to make sure that there's that equity of options across the state, which is what the Medicaid policy does allow.
And Kevin, Elisa was saying patients need to do their homework and not assume that everything is covered. Do you agree with that?
I think that certainly is an important part of the equation, and you want people to do that to be safe. And I think certainly, obviously, the provider and the health deliverer can also play a role in educating, and that can be a conversation. I think, as we've talked about, reimbursement is increasing and is growing, and as the evidence continues to become even stronger for those situations and those aspects of healthcare delivery for which telemedicine is equivalent to traditional, then as the evidence grows, the reimbursement will also grow.
One last question for you, Kevin. Can you tell us a story of someone who has used telemedicine and benefited from it?
Sure. So I'll tell a story that I was involved even in my role as a tele-emergency provider. So there was a family who was vacationing in the Whites, going to Mount Washington with their 9-month-old, and their very healthy 9-month-old was in the car seat, had been well, had just thrown up twice, and then became minimally responsive. And fortunately, they were very close to one of our many great critical access hospitals, brought the patient into the emergency department where they participate in tele-emergency. So really what that means is one of the healthcare team there hit the button on the wall. Their healthcare provider, nurse, and team, we joined them from our hub in Lebanon. So me as the tele-emergency doc and my tele-emergency nurse, we joined in and said, how can we help? And now we have a bird's eye view of patient, of room, of monitors, of all that's going on. This turned out to be a very unusual situation, but together over a couple hours, we worked together, initiated interventions and conversations. We happened to sit in our connected care center with DART and transfer center, involved our specialist, initiated transport. Patient came to our hospital, even though our goal is for them to stay close to home, and then ultimately was discharged a week later, completely healthy, happy, and back to their normal energetic self.
That's Kevin Cullen, Medical Director of Connected Care at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. We also have Elisa Drusba here, Director of New Hampshire Rural Health and Primary Care at the State Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you very much for being on the program today, both of you. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This has been The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.